and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. And we're just learning as we go to air that Paul Manafort has been sentenced by a sympathetic Republican judge in Virginia to 47 months in prison. And of course, next week, before Judge Amy Berman Jackson of the United States District Court for the District of Columbia, he will be facing sentencing on two conspiracy charges, which carry 5 years each, either consecutively or concurrently. And of course, we'll be covering this on Sunday's program. But now on today's program, we'll begin with Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown deciding not to run in the crowded field of potential Democratic presidents and candidates, joining a growing number of hopefuls who have dropped out, notably Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley, former Attorney General Eric Holder, Mayor Michael Bloomberg, and Hillary Clinton. Robert Creamer, a longtime political organizer and strategist and author of Stand Up Straight, How Progressives Can Win, who is a partner in Democracy Partners and has been a Democratic consultant in the last three presidential campaigns, joins us. We will discuss whether talented candidates are being discouraged from entering the race because it will be too difficult to stand out, particularly on debate stages that may be so crowded that the field will have to split into two with primary debates run on consecutive nights. And since Governor Jay Inslee of Washington State has already indicated he wants to make the urgent need to deal with global warming his signature issue, we will assess whether there is a value in having important issues aired, even if it gets in the way of having the cream rise to the top. Then we will examine further whether, at perhaps the most critical juncture in recent American history, when it is imperative for the political opposition to find a candidate who can defeat Donald Trump to save the country and the world from further damage and greater disaster, the Democrats are already blowing it out of the gate with too many hopefuls crowding out promising candidates. Matt Engel, who directs the Texas Democratic Trust and the Lone Star Project and was executive director of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee and the executive director of the House Democratic Caucus, joins us to discuss whether, even if old divisions resurface, new talent will emerge. Then finally, we'll examine the distraction underway in the House with needless arguments among Democrats over anti-Semitism versus Islamophobia following reckless statements by two young House members, which have been gifts handed to Republicans to demagogue and derail important legislative agendas like H.R. 1 while taking attention away from the groundbreaking passage of gun control legislation. Lara Friedman, the president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace, joins us to discuss how Congresswoman Omar and Tlaib are lightning rods no matter what they say, but inevitably they will stimulate a different debate on Israeli-Palestinian issues rather than the narrow debate the Israeli right and their right-wing backers in the U.S. want to impose. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now, Robert Creamer, a longtime political organizer and strategist and author of Stand Up Straight, How Progressives Can Win. He's a partner in Democracy Partners and has been a Democratic consultant in the last three presidential campaigns. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Creamer.
Good to be with you, Ian.
Well, thanks, Bob. And what are we to make of Sherrod Brown dropping out of the race? And shortly before that happened, Jeff Merkley dropped out, and of course Michael Bloomberg as well. Are these candidates, particularly someone like Sherrod Brown, who seemed to be a very viable candidate, dropping out, is it because the field is too crowded and they just don't know whether they can stand out in a crowded field?
Well, I'm sure that has something to do with it. I don't know the details of Sherrod's decision. I do know that I thought he was an extraordinarily viable candidate, and that I think he would have been very attractive to young people, and his kind of rumpled anti-charisma sort of guy, and I think he would have been very appealing to working people throughout, particularly the industrial Midwest, which would have been an extraordinarily big credential that he could win those states. But he may have taken into account the fact that that would potentially put his Senate seat up in jeopardy immediately after 2020. which he very much cares about. And as you say, there are a lot of other good candidates in the field. We have an abundance of riches in this campaign so far, of a variety of types, and I think the prospects of our being successful are very high if we don't have the kind of internecine battle that we had last cycle.
Well, but the fact that Bernie Sanders is the front runner and has raised the most money, does that mean that his very presence is going to reignite that battle?
Well, I think there'll be a lot of strongly felt supporters for Bernie. He'll have a very well-organized campaign, and you know, you start where you left off, not where you began. And he'll have a lot of fundraising. He's big donor list. He has big supporter list. So he has to be taken seriously as a major candidate. On the other hand, there are lots of candidates in this field this time. And it's harder to have the kind of polarized situation develop that developed last time with so many good candidates, I think. I mean, who knows how this election will develop? I mean, if two candidates emerge as the only front runners in the early going, then you may see that kind of polarization, which I think would be unfortunate. On the other hand, it may be that there are multiple candidates that emerge in various states, and they certainly all have different strengths. You know, I think Elizabeth Warren has an extraordinarily strong resume, and her commitments to transformative policies is fundamental. Jay Inslee is just entering the race with heavy emphasis on climate change and a heck of a record in Washington State. Kamala Harris has done a great job so far projecting herself as a charismatic leader. Cory Booker has adopted a very populist approach, which I think is appropriate. I mean, a progressive populist approach. You know, we have quite a number of outstanding candidates now, and there may be more entries yet. Bloomberg, on the other hand, I think was very smart not to run, since you know, he's not a very progressive guy, and it's going to be hard for a person who's not a progressive person to win the primary, the Democratic primary.
Well, but do you think some of the candidates, like Julian Castro, for example, are they running for vice president? Do they have a realistic shot? I mean, in other words, going back to my original question, Bob, you know, right. are there just too many in the race where we're losing a lot of good people, like Sherrod Brown, simply because he's figuring, well, you know, how do I stand out in this crowded field?
I don't know. I mean, Castro has a lot of great attributes. It's hard to know at this stage who's going to catch fire. Just to go back to Barack Obama, I mean, a lot of people thought Barack Obama didn't have a chance to win for the United States Senator from Illinois, and that was because he had a funny name, and suddenly he just stood out. Part of it has to do with personal qualities. Part of it has to do with metrics that you create for the campaign. Bernie was seen as a marginal candidate at the early part of the last going, and he created as a metric rally size, and that gave people enough excitement that he then was able to build this huge fundraising base. Barack, when he ran first time for president, his first metric was he raised a bunch of money because he had a base of support in Chicago, and then he had to win Iowa, and he put everything into the field operation in Iowa and had to convince his donors that was a smart move, but it was. I don't know which of these things each of these candidates, what metric each of them is going to end up choosing. It doesn't have to be the same one to demonstrate they're a serious contender, but I think it's fair to say that anybody who says right now they know who's going to win the nomination is not very smart. I think it's hard to know right now who will be the ultimate nominee. And certainly in the calculation has to be for a number of these people, possibly they might be a vice presidential candidate. If they're not a presidential candidate, they're not the winner. But and for a number of them, playing a major role in national politics, even if you don't win, increases your overall influence politically. So we'll just have to see in the near term and who else gets in too.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Creamer, who's a longtime political organizer and strategist and author of Stand Up Straight, How Progressives Can Win. He's a partner in Democracy Partners and has been a Democratic consultant in the last three presidential campaigns. But you'd like, as much as you like Jay Inslee, and I think he is very telegenic and he's very, very sharp, and he's got a very strong message on climate change, And that's really helpful. If he wants to take that lane, I could see how these debates would be really helpful, bringing in issues. Whether the candidates win or not, I think, you know, is not that important as long as important stuff gets discussed. But I don't know whether you can count on that, you know, being sort of people sticking to their lanes, if you will. So is that a possibility? I mean, in other words, are some of these candidates valuable simply because of the issues they're bringing to the table?
Well, they certainly are valuable. And I think in terms of strategy, you know, Jay obviously has decided that he's going to create to stand out a signature issue that is of great importance to large numbers, particularly of young people who need to be mobilized. Jay also has, by the way, a terrific record from the point of view of Washington in terms of a whole range of populist progressive issues that are appealing in places like Ohio and Pennsylvania, as well as this kind of climate change focus on in other places. I would say this, though, Ian, I mean, the one thing that worries me the most right now is the presence of Howard Schultz as a candidate. If Howard Schultz runs as an independent, he has no prayer in the world of winning, but he could peel off enough people to cost us the election and give Donald Trump another 4 years. And that would be a tragedy. I mean, there's a good case to be made. Our old friend Ralph Nader, you know, really contributed to Al Gore's defeat and as a consequence, you know, to George Bush's presidency, which cost the Iraq War, which caused the Great Recession. I mean, these kind of third-party candidates can be extremely destructive. So I would hope that your listeners would contact Howard Schultz and say, you know, you're no longer with your emeritus president of Starbucks, but let the Starbucks manager know this is a terrible idea.
Well, to tell you the truth, Bob Creamer, I think that if he does run, I think that a lot of young voters are going to start boycotting Starbucks.
I think that's right. Frankly, it'd be a big sacrifice for me personally, but I would do it. I'll tell you that. I mean, it's worth a great deal not to have that third-party candidate in there that's going to take away votes. I mean, you know, Jill Stein took enough votes, 4.6% of the electorate either didn't vote, that voted for Obama, did not vote last time, or voted for a third party. That was the bulk of the difference in what was involved in electing Donald Trump. Not people who switched to Trump from Obama. There was a smaller percentage that did that. But then we had a little percentage, a couple of points, that moved from Romney to Clinton because they hated Trump's, you know, xenophobia and his Islamophobia and his racism and all the things that we've come to dislike about him. You know, I think this question of not voting, being discouraged from voting, or going to vote for a third party is a huge factor in any potentially upcoming presidential election, and we have to take that very seriously. You know, we need a candidate who can mobilize young people and capture their imagination. At the same time, we need someone who can credibly argue that he or she understands ordinary people, and if they take office, they will actually lead the most progressive period in modern American history, one that changes the economic structures and the political structures that have yielded the kind of stagnation in wages and income that we've seen in the last 30 years, where every dime of the 48% increase in gross domestic product per person has gone to the top 1%. I mean, that's a fundamental structural issue that we have to deal with if we take power again. And if we don't, we're in real trouble. And if we do, we could really transform the country.
Well, I really hope people have learned that lesson from this incredibly narrow Electoral College victory that Donald Trump won with only 77,000 votes in Pennsylvania, right, Michigan, and Wisconsin. And in all of those three key states, Jill Stein siphoned off more votes than would have gone to Hillary Clinton. So you could make that case. And again, if Howard Schultz just siphons off that small percentage that Jill Stein managed to do, it could cost the election. Of course, now we're learning that Donald Trump wants a second term more than ever because he'll be protected from indictment.
So he's
a very motivated candidate.
You imagine having a candidate whose principal reason to run is so he cannot be indicted. It's amazing, really. But the opportunity we have in 2 years, a year and a half now, is so great. And the good news is that I think most Democrats, the field, certainly the center of the party, has moved to understand that there is a progressive consensus in the United States with respect to most major issues. This country is not polarized like in half. I mean, there are, on virtually any issue you talk about, we have a substantial progressive majority. The problem is that majority's will is not being translated into political action by the political apparatus of the country, partially because of the structure of the campaign finances, partially because of the gerrymandering, all the kind of thing that goes on that we can overcome in this election in 2020. I mean, I want us to remember Trump as not as the most misogynistic, bigoted, dangerous, unqualified president, but as the guy who yielded such a progressive backlash that we have the most progressive period in modern American history. And I think we can do that.
Well, it's not just aspirational, it's necessary, because you got to repair the damage, right? I mean, the damage that's being done on a daily basis is profound. This team of grifters he has in his cabinet is just shocking beyond belief. And most of all, it's the denial of – it's not the denial of climate change that's so dangerous. It's the fact that we have such a narrow window to deal with it, that he's closed that window and he's reversing what little progress has been made. So there again, maybe that's an opening for Jay Inslee, or at least for his message.
That could be. I mean, the two great threats, right, that he can to the destruction of the species that he could single-handedly help facilitate, that is to say Trump, would be a accidental, miscalculated, or whatever, otherwise nuclear war, or doing things that prevent us from addressing that climate change crisis challenge that you just described. And, of course, the big threat of Trump continuing over the next couple of years, a year and a half, is that may happen. On the other hand, I don't hold out a lot of hope, unless the bottom really falls out on Trump, which is possible, that the Republicans in the Senate would vote to convict if the House impeached him for virtually anything. But, you know, right now, Trump has basically convinced a lot. The reason he did that shutdown, for instance, was not so much about the wall. It was to mobilize his base around the wall, to put the fear of God in these senators, these Republican senators, that he could primary them. And that's his firewall. I mean, he has to keep those senators in the Senate that are Republican swing voters afraid of him. And that he does through mobilizing his base through red meat.
Well, I've often said, Bob Cremer, that I don't think Trump will go out of the Oval Office either in an orange jumpsuit or a straitjacket, but I think he's more likely to go out in a public meltdown live on TV like Howard Beale in the Movie Network, and which is now a Broadway play. He almost did that the other day in that most recent rally at CPAC. And earlier at that long, whatever it was, in the Rose Garden when he announced the national emergency. I mean, he's really starting to look like he's on the verge of a meltdown.
I agree. I mean, and people then say, well, how is it all these folks can ignore all that and continue to support him? I mean, there's not a huge percentage of the country, but there's a big chunk. And I was telling him, politics is not about some list of qualities you calculate. Oh, well, this candidate has these qualities and that kind of, it's not a chart like that. It's more like falling in love. You fall in love with somebody who makes you feel good about yourself. Donald Trump made a bunch of folks who felt left out, felt like the country was passing them by, felt like their kids didn't have better futures. I mean, largely for economic reasons. Feel good about themselves, partially by scapegoating, Muslims, African Americans, minorities, immigrants, and of course the best way to get somebody to fall out of love with somebody is to get them to fall in love with somebody else. So we need a candidate who some of those voters can fall in love with. A lot of them will never, but some of them will. I do believe we have the prospect of a major sweep in 2020 if we nominate a candidate who can appeal to those people genuinely, make them feel they have authenticity. And that was, by the way, one of the other things I just love about Sherrod. He's so authentic. And, you know, they're looking for voters, for candidates, voters right now who are authentic and real and not Mr. Polished Paul, you know?
Well, there's a lot of, at least the young voters and certainly donors fell in love with Beto O'Rourke, so we'll see whether he joins.
Yep.
But just in closing, just to recap, though, Robert Creamer, Sherrod Brown's dropped out. Jeff Merkley decided not to run.
And Sherrod was never in officially.
Exactly.
He decided not to put himself out. Yeah,
but he's on a kind of listening tour following in the footsteps of Martin Luther King's Justice for Workers. Eric Holder's dropped out. Michael Bloomberg dropped out. Hillary Clinton. So there's something going on here. And let's see who drops in, right?
Well, that's right. And there are a couple of other big potential players who might. I mean, Joe Biden may decide to run. And there may be other comers. Some of them may be surprises. And, of course, then there's the class of, like this fellow who's the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, who most people would say doesn't have a prayer. But, crazier things can happen.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Robert Creamer.
Good to be with you. All right. Talk to you later.
Indeed. And again, I've been speaking with Robert Creamer, a longtime political organizer and strategist and author of Stand Up Straight, How Progressives Can Win. He is a partner in Democracy Partners and has been a Democratic consultant in the last three presidential campaigns. We're going to take a restation break and back looking into whether the Democrats are already blowing it out of the gate with too many hopefuls crowding out promising candidates. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Matt Engel, who directs the Texas Democratic Trust and the Lone Star Project, a political action committee that aims to be an aggressive fact-checker on the Republican Party, both at the state and national levels. Matt Engel has served as executive director of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and from 2000 to 2004, he's the executive director of the House Democratic Caucus. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matt Engel.
Hi, Ian.
So, Matt, a lot of candidates are not entering the race, which looks like a pretty crowded Democratic primary for president in 2020. And I don't know whether they decided that they're not going to stand out in a crowded field, but it does feel like some real talent is being lost here, particularly Sherrod Brown and before that Jeff Merkley. Michael Bloomberg, of course, is not running. Hillary Clinton's not running. Reassure me, Matt, that the Democrats aren't screwing this thing up out of the gate because they have too many candidates running and that's going to end up denying some talented people entering the race.
Well, I don't think that it's closed off our opportunities going forward. But it is a shame, though, that somebody as talented as Sherrod Brown decided to pass because he is very, very capable. And certainly if he were to win the nomination, I think he'd be a strong candidate. But there are also a number of people who are in the race now who, if nominated, I think would be very strong, serve the country well, and could beat Donald Trump. And so I don't think things have gotten away from us at all. And it's probably, in the large scheme of things, a very positive that we've got a lot of new faces, some fresh blood into the race. And I think ideologically things will even out. There's a tendency always to want to focus on the edges, focus on how far to the right the Republicans are and how far to the left the Democrats might go. But I think at the end of the day, you're going to see some mainstream points of view go forward. And I think the truth of the matter is that in the fallout of Trump, that it's not so much that the Democratic Party is moving to the left, it's that the country is looking for alternatives and also seeing that this ideological right control of the Congress and of the presidency has really caused some problems. And so I think what you'll see is an adjustment and a correction more than a swing to the left.
And at this point, I guess Bernie Sanders would be the front runner since he's raised a ton of money. And we don't know whether Biden is going to enter the race. But do you expect that the mere presence of Bernie Sanders in this race will revive some of those tensions that arose in the last presidential primary between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders? Do you think that that's going to resurrect itself in terms of the battle between the progressive wing and whatever you want to call the centrist wing?
I don't think so. I think a lot of Bernie's traction from 4 years ago, or almost 4 years ago, was that he was seen as the only alternative to Hillary Clinton. If people, for whatever the reason was, that they weren't satisfied with Hillary Clinton, they either went to Bernie or they stayed home or just groused. And I think now there's a lot of options to Bernie. And Bernie is outside the mainstream in a number of ways. I think there's another thing, too, that's really important that I think is going to make it harder for Bernie. And that is a much broader recognition that he's not really a Democrat, that he runs as a Democrat. And he had to say this time that he's a Democrat. But even following the 2016 elections, he wouldn't say out loud that he's a Democrat, and he didn't run for re-election to the Senate as a Democrat. And that rubs a lot of people who vote in primaries the wrong way. And so I think that the energy behind Bernie, despite the fact that he still raises a lot of money online, I think the energy behind Bernie is much diminished.
So where is the energy then? Do you see somebody that's going to be his heir and capture that energy?
Well, I don't think they're his heir from the standpoint of, I don't think there's anybody who really, any other candidate who really falls into the category of being a socialist Democrat. And I don't think a socialist Democrat can get nominated or certainly get elected. But I do think you have some candidates, a number of them, that have a chance to pick up that energy, and particularly the support among young people and young voters. Certainly, I think that Kamala Harris has a chance to pick up support along those lines. I certainly think that if Beto O'Rourke gets in the race, he has a chance to pick up some of that energy. And so I think that, again, Bernie is certainly has the right to run, and he'll probably have the money to stay in a while, but I just don't see him cornering that market this time.
And again, I'm speaking with Matt Engel, who directs the Texas Democratic Trust and the Lone Star Project. He's a political action committee that aims to be an aggressive fact checker on the Republican Party, both at the state and national levels. Matt Engel has served as executive director of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and he was the executive director of the House Democratic Caucus. So we don't know about Beto O'Rourke. He did certainly get a lot of attention and raise an awful lot of money when he was running against Ted Cruz. What's going on with him, do you think? You're the Texan.
I expect that Beto's going to get in the race. I don't pretend that I have inside information, but everything that I see and everything that I hear makes me think that he's going to run. He decided not to seek the Senate seat in Texas, which he would have been the strongest candidate and very much, to me, would have likely won it. The fact that he didn't do that makes me think that he certainly does see a path and sees a way as a presidential candidate. And so at this point, I'll be surprised if he doesn't run.
So he's turned down running for Cornyn's seat.
That's correct.
And he's no longer a congressman too, right?
That's correct. When he ran for the U.S. Senate last time, of course, he couldn't run for Congress also. Although it is interesting that in Texas, you can run for the U.S. Senate and run for president at the same time, but he decided not to take that path.
Right. So Jay Inslee seems a fairly telegenic and interesting character. He seems to be wanting to run largely on the climate change issue. Do you see that as a possible way that a division of labor, if you will, if you've got a crowded field, and particularly when you get to these debates, and they're already talking about having to split the field up into two sections of, say, 10 on one night and 10 on another. The fact that that candidates would be seizing on one issue, is that a way to bring important issues into the public square?
It certainly is a way to draw attention to yourself. And I think, though, you've got to be like Governor Inslee and actually know what you're talking about on an important issue. So I think the fact that he is settled on an issue that is very important, not just to Democrats, but to a lot of people out there, and that he is truly somebody who knows that issue from a policy standpoint and from a political standpoint, I think that's a smart move. I know a little bit about him. I remember when he was a member of the House of Representatives, highly respected. His colleagues looked to him on a lot of policy issues. And so I think he may surprise people from the standpoint of him being capable on a lot of issues, not just on climate change. The question for me is whether or not he can put together the finances and raise the money you need to stay in a crowded field until you kind of spread, you create some separation.
And Hickenlooper has joined in. I must say he seems a little quirky to me, but what about Governor Bullock of Montana?
Is he? Well, he's interesting to me. I don't know him personally, but I followed him, given that he's a Democrat who's won in a red state. And now it's a small state, but the fact that you can win as a Democrat in a state like that means that you are able to build a coalition, means that you are able to get people who might have to really look past just your party label to be for you. That says something about his political skills. And so, again, I think he would bring something to the table. I have great respect for people who have run and taken something away from a Republican or run as a Democrat in an area that's otherwise hard for Democrats to win in.
So given that most of the candidates in the race now tend to be on the more liberal side of the Democratic Party, that's Bernie and Elizabeth Warren and also Kamala Harris, it's Kirsten Gillibrand. I guess she's also seems to be courting the liberal vote. So in terms of centrists, who's left? And Biden's not in the race, but Amy Klobuchar, I guess, would be considered a centrist. Does that?
I think that Amy Klobuchar certainly fills the bill, and people forget about Julian Castro. He's running, and don't underestimate him. He's somebody who has really thought this through. He's got a strategy to stay in this thing, and he also is. I think he's certainly progressive, and he's certainly somebody who represents the values and the views of Democrats. But he's also a pragmatic guy who has come from a state in which you've got to find solutions. And sometimes that means moving away from an extreme point of view. And so I wouldn't underestimate the value that Castro brings to the race as well, beyond just the fact that he's the only Latino in the race.
Well, I perhaps have been a little unkind and suggested that he might be running for vice president. Do you think that's is that an unkind characterization?
Well, I think it's unkind because it's an obvious thought by anybody who hasn't thought about it. But I will tell you, I don't think there's a person in the race this side of Joe Biden who wouldn't accept a running mate position.
So that's always the fallback, right?
Yeah, nothing wrong with that. If LBJ taught us nothing else.
Right. So just to sort of wrap up here, though, because I started out with a certain amount of, you know, anxiety that I find Trump so appalling and so dangerous and so demeaning. It's upsetting, and have on a daily basis having to cover his antics and realizing that you are being manipulated because this reality TV guy doesn't have a clue about how to govern. So it's government by stunt, and the country's being torn apart and divided. I don't have to go on. It's just terrible what's going on. And so the anxiety is such that you really, the Democrats simply have to win this one. And we know that it's that nowadays races are much tighter than people think they are. Nobody's had a blowout since, I think, Nixon in 72. So, you know, and you got Howard Schultz in there. He could split enough people off. So reassure me that the fact that a lot of good candidates like Merkley and Eric Holder and Sherrod Brown are not running, that we're not going to blow this one.
Well, first of all, Ian, your anxiety is understandable because Donald Trump's election is a national disaster and just a horrible, horrible thing to fall down on not just the people of our country, but to the world. And so it is natural for us to worry and think, oh, my goodness, let's don't mess this up. That being said, I don't think things are out of hand. I think, again, there are a number of candidates who are in the race now. If nominated, would beat him, and I do think that we are going to see one or two more people into the race that will strengthen the field. But it's going to depend on all of us as not just Democrats, but as Americans to not argue the perfect against the good. And I saw some of that in the 2018 elections, even when Trump wasn't on the ballot. I saw a number of people participate and get involved in campaigns knowing they didn't agree with a specific candidate on every issue, but know that they needed to change the dynamic and change the direction of where the country was going. And so they participated, not only voted, but they donated and they knocked on doors. And I think we're going to see that at a level we haven't seen in quite some time.
Well, Matt Engel, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Matt Engel, who directs the Texas Democratic Trust and the Lone Star Project, a political action committee that aims to be an aggressive fact-checker on the Republican Party, both at the state and national level. Matt Engel has served as executive director of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee and was executive director of the House Democratic Caucus. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back discussing how Congresswoman Omar and Tlaib are lightning rods no matter what they say, but inevitably they will stimulate a different debate on Israeli-Palestinian issues rather than the narrow debate the Israeli right and their right-wing backers in the U.S. want to impose.
You don't need to change your futures. You don't need to change.
Oh,
welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Lara Friedman, who is the president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace. Prior to that, she was the director of policy and government relations at Americans for Peace Now. And before that, she was a U.S. Foreign Service officer serving in Jerusalem, Washington, Tunis, and Beirut. Lara is a leading authority on U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, with particular focus on the Arab-Israeli conflict, settlements, and Jerusalem, and on the role of the U.S. Congress. And she frequently briefs members of Congress, administration officials, and others in the foreign policy national security community, and is regularly published in the U.S. and Israeli press. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lara Friedman.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
So, Lara, this whole furore over Representative Ilhan Omar's remarks seems to have really damaged the Democrats, not in any lasting sense, but it's certainly thrown them off their agenda. They're trying to push H.R. 1, which is an ambitious bill to deal with a whole bunch of issues in terms of improving our democracy and stopping voter suppression, etc. So they have an ambitious agenda, and it just seems like they're flaying around over something that in both cases, the attacks on Ilhan Omar have been exaggerated for sure, But still, she didn't do anybody any favors, and neither did Rashida Tlaib by using in one sentence the two very words that the Republicans are running against, in a sense, or trying to pin the Democrats to. The one word is impeach, and the other one, of course, is an obscenity. She said, well, you know, we're going to impeach the MF. Well, you know, don't you think it's important that the Democrats are different from our present occupant of the Oval Office who uses obscenities? And secondly, they don't want to advertise impeachment. They know that that's going to be used against them. So I guess this is a long-winded way of saying I don't think it's particularly helpful to give Republicans ammunition.
So, you know, I speak as a foreign policy wonk in Washington. I'm not a political animal, and this I'm as much an observer as anyone else. Without sounding too standoffish on this, I don't think it's helpful to be giving advice on what Democrats should or shouldn't be doing, or what anybody should or shouldn't be doing. The bottom line is, I think this was a fight that was going to happen as soon as Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib were elected. I think it was very clear that this fight was going to happen, and in some ways, I think it's better that it happens sooner rather than later, and we get it out of the way, and maybe Democrats can manage to clear the decks. If you look at the attacks against Ilhan Omar, and really even if you feel that some of the things that she has said in these two rounds somehow trigger a sense in you that there might be anti-Semitism, and I don't discount, you know, friends of mine who I take seriously and who, you know, nothing she has said to me feels like anti-Semitism, but if it does to other people, then I respect that. But the level of outrage and the level of the demands for retribution and apologies, it reflects something that is bigger than this. And, you know, my belief is, and I said this to people really as soon as we saw the results of the elections, there was a sense among some in the grassroots that now that you had a couple of people in Congress who were clearly and openly aligned ideologically with the Palestinian cause, you are going to see an opening of real debate for the first time. And there's never been any real debate. There's never been really a Palestinian perspective reflected or discussed in Congress. And people were very excited about that. And my feeling was that's possible, but I think just as likely and maybe more likely you're going to see folks who don't want there to ever be that debate seeking to sort of jujitsu this moment and very do everything they can to make sure that these members of Congress and anything they touch is radioactive and send a message that no one shall touch this issue and really try to use them to put this once and for all to bed. And I think that's what we're seeing here. I would suggest respectfully that even if Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib were careful in the sense that people say that I wish they were being more careful, I think no matter how they articulate their views, if they articulate any views that are in any way sympathetic to the Palestinian people, and that is how they feel, and they were elected by people who knew they felt that way, if they articulate those views in any way, they're going to come under attack. And the Democrats need to get through this and come out the other end, hopefully with some sort of understanding that there is space in the Democratic Party for a range of views on Israel-Palestine, and that it is not automatically anti-Semitic to talk about the Palestinians or to criticize Israel or Israeli policy. And along the way, hopefully people who want to bring up and promote the cause of Palestinians will learn to navigate this skillfully or more skillfully. And you know what? If there are people who are genuinely anti-Semitic, I think that's going to be clear over time as well. But what we've seen so far doesn't tell us that at all.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more, and I wish the debate was about what you're talking about. I'm just complaining that one can't afford to give the Republicans gifts like this because they don't have a platform and everything. They're complete hypocrites. They have a president who's a racist in chief who says the most appalling things. And he says that those neo-Nazis who are chanting at Charlottesville, Jews will not replace us, he called them a very fine people. So the other side doesn't have a leg to stand on. It's just depressing that out of the gate that the Republicans are able to make hay over something that is that they don't have a leg to stand on, but they're beating the drum as much as they can.
I agree. I agree that it's depressing. I guess partly for me, I'm saying it's not surprising. I think this is a battle that's going to have to be fought, and it's still being fought. And I'm hopeful coming out of the other end of it, we will see Democrats. And frankly, it should be bipartisan. We'll see people in general believing and understanding there's more space to talk about the issues here and not debate and fight and attack each other over language. I hope for that. I don't think there was any way that we were going to avoid a fight of this nature. We have seen now for the past few years with the issue of BDS, which has been weaponized as a test for are you pro-Israel or are you anti-Semitic, right? If you will not, we have an effort now to make legislation that the ACLU says is unconstitutional, to have this made in Congress into a litmus test of support for Israel, which is quite extraordinary. There is a desperate need for a recalibration in our political system, in both parties, of what is and isn't allowable in terms of discussing a key foreign policy issue of our time. And that is, these are some of, I think, maybe the growing pains of that. And it is regrettable. In some sense, though, let's have this now and get it over with. And again, I hope as we come out the other end of this, the other end of this isn't people saying, okay, well, now they've learned they won't dare raise the issues of Israel-Palestine again because they see that they will, you know, it will cause people to hemorrhage political capital if they do. Because that is a lesson that I think a lot of people would like to have come out of this. Just let them shut up or let them be called anti-Semites. And my hope is that what will come out of this at the other end is a lesson which says we have to have these conversations. There has to be space in both parties for a reasonable and sober discussion about Israel, about the Palestinians, without AIPAC or the RJC or anyone else setting the rules for what people can and cannot say. And that isn't about anti-Semitism or not anti-Semitism. That's about policy.
And again, I'm speaking with Lara Friedman, who's the president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace. And prior to that, she was the director of policy and government relations at Americans for Peace Now. And before that, she was a U.S. Foreign Service officer serving in Jerusalem, Washington, Tunis, and Beirut. She's a leading authority on U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, with particular focus on the Arab-Israeli conflict, settlements, and Jerusalem, and on the role of the U.S. Congress. And she frequently briefs members of Congress, administration officials, and others in the foreign policy national security community, and is regularly published in the U.S. and the Israeli press. Well, I think one of the realities here that's underlying this is given that many of the new crop of Democrats are young and progressive, and those that are critical of Omar, the Democratic caucus tend to be longer serving members. And it does seem that there's a generational shift underway with young Democrats, again, you know, who are totally disenchanted with Netanyahu, not necessarily with Israel. And that, I think, is something that the Israelis have to deal with. It's inexorable. They've lost a lot of support in Europe, and they may well start losing support here in the United States, particularly with the younger generation. You don't have to be a political scientist to notice that Netanyahu went after Obama at every turn. He supported Romney, and he actually showed up, tried to stop Obama's deal with Iran. He's really intruded in our politics in a way that are deeply partisan. Surely that people have noticed it over here. Now he's embracing the far right fringe in Israeli politics. So do you think you can frame this thing more in terms of right-wing politics being the problem, whether they're in Israel or in the United States?
I think that's certainly a framing that makes a lot of sense right now. I think it's, you know, left-wing and right-wing have come to have very different meanings, and we're seeing all sorts of shifts in the body politic. And I would say that, you know, at this moment in time, when I talk to students on campuses, if for generations there has been what folks called sort of almost an Israel exception when it came to progressive politics, you know, there was a certain lens, whether it was on human rights or civil society or freedom of speech, things that we didn't look at. You didn't examine the occupation the same way. We're dealing with a generation that isn't willing to continue with that sort of Israel exception. It's what my friends in the Palestinian community have long called the, you know, progressive except on Palestine problem. I think we have a generation which isn't willing to be progressive except on anything. They say, these are the courage of my convictions, and it applies across the board. And that is an enormous challenge to generations that have come to believe that you know, whether because of needs of political reasons or because, you know, a deep love of Israel that simply just can't abide looking at some of the things that are more difficult to see that are happening in Israel. It's an enormous challenge. I would add, and going back to what I said a little while ago about free speech, you know, if you look at what happened at the beginning of the year in the Senate when there was the debate over legislation which is ostensibly about protecting Israel from boycotts, and what it really is about helping allowing states to legislate against Americans' free speech. Regardless of how you feel about boycotts of Israel or settlements, that is something that I would think would trouble people. And there were two members of Congress who spoke incredibly powerfully on the Senate floor against this. And one of them was a younger senator from Maryland, who is Chris Van Hollen. And the other one was Rand Paul, who is a libertarian Republican and who made an impassioned plea for free speech. This isn't really a partisan thing necessarily. We're hitting a moment when Israeli policies are getting harder and harder for Americans when they are seeing their basic values as Americans challenged. It's getting harder and harder for Americans to stay quiet or to make a case that they should stay quiet. And as we see elections bring to power people who are younger and who are more responsive at a grassroots level, whether it's because they're fundraising differently or because they come out of a different organizing tradition or whatever it is, it's going to be very difficult for the longer-serving leaders to impose an orthodoxy on these young members of Congress. I think what we're seeing now, and again, I see these as sort of growing pains for Congress. I think if we weren't doing this now, we'd be doing this after the next election, because we are going to see more and more members of Congress elected who are representing constituencies who are saying, you need to have the courage of your conviction across the board. And that includes having a more robust discussion and more robust questioning of U.S. policy when it comes to supporting Israel, when Israel is undertaking policies that are antithetical to our values as progressive Americans, including progressive American Jews who do care about Israel.
Well, Netanyahu will be coming over here before the April 9th elections. I think he's speaking at APEC, but I guess he'll be doing some electioneering. But as you're a former Foreign Service officer, and I cover foreign policy as much as I can and have a great deal of interest in U.S. foreign policy, and as you know, the old expression, Lara, is that when America sneezes, the world catches a cold. And having worked in Europe and having grown up in Australia, I have a somewhat different perspective in the sense that what I find extraordinary is that Israel gets so much attention geopolitically, particularly from the United States, and maybe that has gone to Netanyahu's head in the sense that that there is this disproportionate attention, the proportionality of it's extraordinary. The Australian Prime Minister, for example, I think we know that Trump got mad at the guy that Murdoch got rid of, and now they have another one of Murdoch's people in as Prime Minister on the conservative side. But, you know, Donald Trump hung up the phone on the previous Australian Prime Minister, and of course that would never happen with Netanyahu. And in terms of a broader perspective on U.S. foreign policy, is Israel indulged too much?
So I don't know how to answer that question. I don't know what too much would be. There is a deep and long and rich relationship that goes back to the beginnings of the State of Israel through the current day. And it has elements that are grounded in U.S., you know, foreign policy in the region. It's grounded in our interests in terms of keeping Israel safe and our commitment to Israel after World War II. It's shared in theory. It's grounded a great deal in shared values. That's something that's challenged increasingly every day as the Netanyahu government embraces more and more illiberal policies. I don't know what it means to be indulged too much in terms of having a relationship. I would say that, you know, to the extent that we have, that the U.S. president, this president or any president, has the ability to engage the Israeli prime minister and have some influence on their policy. The fact that we have presidents that do not use that influence to press for policies that are more helpful in terms of ending the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, or in the case of this administration that appear to actually egg on the worst instincts of the Israeli prime minister, that doesn't seem to be helping anybody.
Well, one person who is the biggest donor to the Trump campaign apparently has an enormous amount of influence, not just here in the United States, but in Israel. And I'm talking about Sheldon Adelson. He has a free newspaper that's dedicated to promoting Netanyahu. And apparently he's the person who urged Trump to take on John Bolton. But I think when I was referring to being indulged, I think Israel still gets the lion's share as the biggest recipient of U.S. foreign aid. And it's a pretty successful and wealthy country from what I can tell.
I'm not sure it's the biggest recipient in the post-Iraq era. It's certainly one of the largest recipients, absolutely, no question.
So in the last couple of minutes then, where do you see this? Do you think we get the Pelosi and the Democrats will get them back on the rails and forge ahead with their important agenda rather than be distracted by this something that the Republicans are obviously enjoying? As you said earlier, and I entirely agree with you, that at some point or other, there will always be a problem with these two young Muslim women who have just been elected to the House, in a sense that the Palestinian issue is a lightning rod, but it's one that can no longer be buried. And to that extent, you're welcoming it, and I am welcoming it. So do you think we'll get on towards a healthy debate, or perhaps even Netanyahu himself will help propel that debate as he moves further to the right?
Look, I mean, I've worked in politics long enough to not pretend I have a crystal ball. My hope is that we are moving in a direction of a political environment in Washington and beyond that not only permits but encourages and embraces this broader debate. And I think that it goes much bigger than Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib. If you look at Bernie Sanders and you look at the last presidential campaign, where with his candidacy he broke down a lot of barriers. He broke down the myth that a presidential candidate cannot take on this issue in a more progressive way. It had always been said that if they did, they would lose support, they would not be able to fundraise, all of that. None of that's true. And with Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, we see that people who take these issues on, if they have the confidence of their constituents, they can be elected, and they're elected with a mandate to be engaged on this issue. And my guess is in 2020, we're going to see more people elected, and they may not look like Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib. I think we're going to have a more and more with each generation, we're going to have more people elected who say, we want to talk about this. And I think it'll be from both parties. And that is only for the good. I don't think that should be seen as an existential threat by anyone. This is to the good. This leads to a stronger policy and a stronger relationship. The only people who fear a debate are people who fear that they cannot defend what is being challenged. And if you feel like you can't defend it, the problem isn't the debate. The problem is that what you've got is indefensible.
Well, Lara Friedman, you've given us a lot to think about, and I appreciate your time very much.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Lara Friedman, who's the president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace. Prior to that, she was the director of policy and government relations at Americans for Peace Now. And before that, she was a U.S. Foreign Service officer serving in Jerusalem, Washington, Tunis, and Beirut. And she's a leading authority on U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, with particular focus on the Arab-Israeli conflict, settlements, and Jerusalem, and on the role of the U.S. Congress. And she frequently briefs members of Congress, administration officials, and others in the foreign policy and national security community, and is regularly published in the United States and Israeli press. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates, as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.